Kia ora, can you hear me?
I can you hear me?
I sure can. How are you going?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm great. I'm really stoked to be talking with you this evening. I'm just going to adjust my mic so squeaky noises are coming. All right, so let's get started. You are a composer, but our listeners might be more familiar with your arrangement and performance collaborations with legendary Kiwi musicians, including Neil Finn, Don McGlashan, Anika Moa, Shapeshifter, and most recently, strings for Tammy Nielsen.
That's right. And also The Veils, too, on their most recent album.
Recent album, cool. How was it working with Tammy?
Tammy is just a glorious human being, and I adore her. So I will, you know, anything she asks of me, I will do gladly.
I'm curious to know what your background is in music and how you've entered all these different facets of it, like, for one, being the music director of the Rugby World Cup in 2011.
Well, I have always been a musician since I can remember, and not just music, the arts generally. I find beauty in lots of things, I guess. And so it's wonderful to be able to dive into different worlds and experiment with them and create collaborations and relationships in them too.
Did you have a first instrument that you played growing up?
I did. Well, I started on the piano and the recorder, and then I learned the oboe.
Oh, that's not a very common one, is it?
No, it's not. And I was kind of, my mother pressed me to learn it because it was not common. I wanted to learn the violin, and in some ways I still wish I had, because the oboe is, it's a beautiful instrument, but it's also a little bit of a punishing instrument to play.
I grew up playing the violin, and I will say that you probably have like a competitive edge when you play a not mainstream instrument, you might say. You get the first seat in the orchestra automatically.
That was my mother's rationale, but there are more jobs for violinists than there are for oboists. So the kind of the possibilities are about the same, actually.
That's a good point. So,
yeah.
Tell us about your role with the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra.
Well, the orchestra has got a performance coming up called Stabat Mater. And the Stabat Mater is an ancient kind of Catholic liturgical poem that has been set to music many, many, many times, and is part of the Catholic Mass. So all sorts of amazing composers have set it to music, including a composer called Rossini, and the NZSO are performing his Stabat Mater. And they approached me and commissioned me to write a contemporary response to that work. The Stabat Mater is a poem about the suffering of the Virgin Mary at the foot of the cross as Jesus is being crucified. And so Rossini's Stabat Mater follows a very particular form, and it uses the poetry directly in terms of what the choir sings and what the music does. And I've gone in something of a different direction.
Before we go into your direction, are you able to make a timeline of how an arrangement like the Stabat Mater has trickle down in contemporary music from sonic to societal influences?
Oh my God, what a great question. I hope I'm up to it. The Western Christian liturgy has influenced everything about the Western musical tradition. So all of the music that we have written down that's been handed to us over generations has come from monasteries and religious places, which actually in turn have been informed by Middle Eastern musical forms. So in fact, it just comes from that part of the world, and it's been carried to us through things like the spice route and migrations across borders and all of that kind of thing. And the people who were able to write it down were the people who were educated, and they tended to be in churches or in royal courts. And so we have this tradition, which includes the Stabat Mater, that has an ancient musical heritage from people like, I guess, Pergolesi and ancient Baroque composers. I think maybe Monteverdi wrote one, and then coming right through the classical tradition, Verdi, I think, gosh, now my knowledge is being tested and I'm worried that I'm failing, but many, many composers have written this musical form. And it has transformed in the same way that that musical tradition has transformed over hundreds of years.
There's a lot to unpack here. Has politics and this larger societal analysis always been present in classical music?
I think that every single composer is of a place in time, and each place in time has its own politics. And in much older times, politics were much more regional. And of course, as our world has globalized, our politics have become more global, and music has followed that trajectory too. Music is a little bit of a pendulum, and sometimes composers as a group or culture as an idea embraces sometimes revolution and also sometimes tries to create a balm for revolution. And so you often see that undulation where, say, for instance, the classical period reacts to complexity by finding elegance and simplicity, and then the Romantic period reacts to the classical period by finding all of the deep, turgid meanings of things. And you see these kinds of flows and responses as music kind of goes through the ages. Always, I think, composers can't help but be political, but they do it sometimes very overtly and sometimes also very secretly or in a slightly subversive way. I have just started to feel recently, just in my own work, that politics is becoming more and more and more important to me. You know, it's one thing to be a creator, but in an environment like the one that we find ourselves in now, I am now starting to find my political self feeling very, very activated by everything around me. And I think I'm by no means alone in that. I'm seeing that in all of the people around me who are making any kind of art. And funnily enough, of course, art is, in a weird way, being quietened by all of these massive technological forces that have kind of devalued it so much and eroded the ability to make a living from it. And you see it being eroded from our school curriculum. And so even just creating it, even being a person who comes from anywhere and thinks, I want to make a piece of art, almost as a political act in defiance of the way that it's being slowly devalued in our society.
So what is your 21st century response to this? Is it the 13th century work?
It is. My 21st century response, I should say for the record that I'm not a religious person, but I do have absolute respect for people of faith. And I could not, in any kind of conscience, use the Stabat Mater text because I'm not religious and it would have felt very disingenuous to do that. And the other thing is that it filled me with a kind of rage when I thought about Mary having to suffer through the torture of her child. And, you know, I'm a mother, I've got three children. I can't imagine what that would feel like. And so I looked around for texts to set to music that expressed something of how I felt about all of that, and couldn't really find anything that quite managed to articulate it, so I wrote my own text. I kind of tried to imagine an alternative future where Mary, in contemplation of the violence that's about to befall her son in the Garden of Gethsemane, decides not to cooperate and saves her child.
Now, you don't have to answer this one, but I am curious to know if you have a background or a childhood in religion that you were also recognizing and creating a distinction and separation.
I do. So I went to religious schools from when I was 5 until when I was 16. I think probably attended church every day in some facility during that time, either chapel or church services. And I went through my own kind of ebb and flow with belief. For a period of time, I was almost evangelical in my acceptance of that thinking, and then began to question it and began to think about other ways of thinking and being in the world. And, you know, the more that you live, the wider your perspective on the world gets after quite an intense schooling. And I've landed in a very open and transparent and elastic space when I think about these things myself.
I like the word elastic, as religion, especially this Catholic, Christian, quite implemented into our colonial society, and growing up in that and being able to pick out pieces from text that you can actually resonate with, but still having a separation between larger forces of power that might be at work there.
I think that actually the entire piece is about power. That's where I got to, you know, really rather than any kind of comment on the faith itself, it's about the power that's represented and the power balance or imbalance is represented, because for 2025 years since Mary supposedly lived, her example of an impossible virginal mother has been used to define what womanhood should be, and by association also what manhood should be. And I think that in many ways that strange set of standards has hurt all of us across the breadth and depth of the gender spectrum. And so elasticity, I think, is what is called for today, and what is a world that seems to be getting more and more binary in its arguments as we wake up every morning.
The virginal mother was always a bit of an oxymoron to me growing up. So what does this sound like, your response?
I mean, the text and the music are kind of two slightly different things. There's a series of statements in the text that I make which talks very much about the way that human beings have corrupted faith. So, for example, it says, "She wants no choirs castrated," because in the olden times they used to so value the voices of boy sopranos that they would castrate them so that their voices would never break. And I kind of think, well, that's a kind of a strange thing to do to a perfect creature of God's creation, isn't it? In the name of God. It is insane. And another line is, "She wants no congregations tithed," because I think that robbing the poor to feed the the compromise to feed the aggrandization of a belief is also wrong. There's another line that says, "No people bound or silenced," because of course this religion has been used as such a colonizing force around the world and has been used to suppress so many people and redefine the way that they exist in the world. And finally, "No false priests fellated," because of course all of the abuse that's happened within that system that it has then sought to deny or ignore in order to protect itself rather than its congregation, which I also think is a very deeply human form of hypocrisy.
It feels like there's a bit of frustration. How does that translate sonically?
The music itself, I thought about that a lot as I was writing. It's a piece that I thought was going to come from the anger that I initially felt, but after contemplating it, then also contemplating her and what I try to imagine what it is that she truly represents, which I landed upon the idea that what she really represents is life. That's what her power is. She's a bringer of life and a creator. You can imagine her as nature, or you can imagine her as the universe if you're going to kind of try and take her out of the kind of biblical idea of who she is. The music actually has become both triumphant and persistent. There's a gentleness. There are moments where she is with her child reflecting on him as a baby in her arms and thinking that, would you commit this violence on a baby? And what makes it all right once people get older to hurt them in that way? The music, I think, tries to find compassion and reflection on that, and also the sense of just steady resistance and triumph rather than anything violent or anything vengeful, because I think she is ultimately a vision of life.
Leaning into the more peaceful side of that, it sounds like an ode to sisterhood and motherhood and all life-giving forces.
Sisterhood and motherhood, and also just the feminine that is present in every single person, because I think too that the denial of the feminine across any person on the gender spectrum has been painful and hurtful in society, and that we are all a kind of a strange and beautiful combination of hormones that express themselves in all sorts of different ways. And I think to deny any one aspect of that or to try and empower it over something else is destructive to just the beautiful delicacy of our individual identities.
That's really lovely. So it's one thing to have this analysis on the work, and another thing for an audience to understand or get your point across through a composition. Mm. I know you haven't had this performed yet to the audience, but have there been any initial reactions from the people close to you?
So the people close to me have read the poem. I've had a wonderful response from people about the poem. We've rehearsed it with the choir once already, and I had a beautiful response from the choir too, including people of faith in the choir, because I did actually really make a point. And in fact, I went and consulted with a couple of people who I knew were of deep faith. I wanted to make sure that my message was clear, that it was not an attack on faith, and that it was more just an examination of how human beings can obscure or corrupt systems of faith. I've dedicated the piece to my children and also to Karen Grills, who was the director of Voices New Zealand and has been rehearsing the choir for this piece, but was also my teacher at Auckland University many decades ago. And so I played it to my children for the first time on Mother's Day so that they could hear this kind of weird, artificial, mocked demo on my computer, which doesn't sound anything like the work. And their response was that they could feel it. They could feel it. And that's the most important thing. All you can ever hope is that you kind of hold up a mirror to people and they see something of themselves in it and they feel something of what you're trying to communicate with them.
I'm wondering if you have any advice for musicians who want to invoke that feeling within their listeners of something that they want to say when it's not necessarily through words or lyrics.
What a lovely question. I think that the one thing that nobody can fake in music of any kind is just genuine creative authenticity and honesty. You know, I think that we live in a world now where there's just so much music. And I know that so many of the people around me who are trying to create struggle with this kind of volume of content. I hate that word so much, but content in the world. And ultimately, we're kind of in a moment where it's really hard to make your voice heard. And some people attempted to then try to do what the audience wants in order to attract the audience to them. And my advice to anybody trying to make any kind of musical or artistic or creative statement is not to give in to that. You know, the audience does not tell art what to do. Art reveals something to the audience. If we find ourselves in a situation where there's only one kind of person who can afford to make art, then we're in big trouble because we need the full spectrum of voices.
Yeah. What do you think is the future for, air quotes, classical compositions as the tool for analysis moving forward? And what are some beginning places you could recommend to start listening to classical music through this lens?
One of the beautiful things about the past few years and the kind of the expansion of the internet is that it has, for the problems that come with it, given us access to everything. And what that's also meant is that creators and composers have had access to completely expand their worldview in terms of what classical music even is. You know, I don't know what classical music is now. I think of it as a free-for-all. So I think that the future of classical music is incredibly beautiful, because the more that I hear of people expanding the boundaries and pushing at the edges, the more in love with it I get. And I realize, you know, as I get older and I look back and all of the dots start to join together in retrospect, that that's what it's always been. It's been this wonderful way to just push at the way people think and to expand what's possible. And I don't think that we're that different now. I think Beethoven did it when he broke pianos trying to find the intensity that he was looking for in his piano writing. And I think that we're doing it now when we bring technology into our work and encourage all sorts of new ways to be in the world of music. I think and I hope for this kind of incredibly diverse art form that it rises to the challenge of being expansive and not being exclusive and not denying access to people in all of the kind of ways that they're curious about it. And I would say, as accessibility goes, in terms of going and finding amazing examples of work, my touch point would be the Bach Goldberg Variations. And then I would go to the other end of the spectrum and listen to something by Dame Gillian Whitehead. And then I would travel back maybe to Brahms, and then I'd maybe travel ahead to Stravinsky or Ligeti, and then I would just start looking here at the local voices, at the way in which that tradition's being interpreted and reinterpreted and explored here in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
Thank you so much, Victoria Kelly.
Oh, that's my pleasure.
Great words from you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Ka kite.
Ka kite anō.